Before we start, I'd like to tell you about something extraordinary that happened as a result of this show. It happened right after the show. The guest that Jeff Kripal and I will be talking to is Sherilee Black, who is a powerful and very unusual person in the realm of other levels of reality. She is a confirmed psychokinetic who has been tested in many labs, and as you'll hear, is also a wonderful, sweet, and warm person. She, as well, had one of the most extraordinary experiences with Anne after Anne passed away of anyone I've ever heard of, and I did not know Sherilee at all. Anne didn't know her either, but Anne went to her in a way that's not possible to deny, and for a reason. And part of that reason is obviously that we're now doing a show like this. Sherilee will be with us next weekend in the subscriber video room, so you can meet and experience her personally. I think it'll be a really enjoyable time. Saturday the 12th at 11 a.m. Pacific in the subscriber video room. And after the show, began to talk to me. Now, I am a poor channel because I don't trust myself. I've got a big mind of my own, and I get in the way of channeling. But suddenly, this seemed very clear. And while I would not say 100% this is Anne, it sounds like her, and it doesn't sound like me. And I think it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever experienced in my life, to write this down and dictate this for her, and now to read it for you. This is from Anne. This is a diary about inner peace. Everyone has inner peace, only we build a kind of shell around it. This shell is made up of fear and hate, but it's a very brittle shell, and you can break through it. You break through it by remembering your heart. Remember what your heart was like when you were 10 years old, open and willing. Whitley talks about real will all the time when he works with people. But this kind of will, the will of a child, is more real than the will of persistence and determination that he talks about. This is what Jesus means when he says, be as little children, because it is innocent, and innocent will is like the will of God. So when you break through that shell that has been created in you by all the negativity that bombards us from every direction, and you find that place of peace within, it is just as fresh in you as it was when you were a little child. The whole journey of enlightenment starts with admitting that you are no longer a child, but that the path to a new childhood is open. This path is a path to what I call a mature childhood, that is to say, innocence that accepts experience. I've got more to say, but I can't say it in words. When you recover your innocence, you will know what I did not say and could not say. It will be part of you, for it belongs to every heart. It is very ancient, and it goes all the way back to a basic discovery that caused all creation. It was the discovery that the universe wasn't here. The instant that was felt, that absence, everything began. The heart of the matter was there before anything began. You can find that in yourself. That original seed of love is still inside you. So step out of the maze of confusion that is daily life and find your heart at the beginning of the world.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today, I think we're going to have a very interesting Dreamland. We have two guests, Sherilee Black and Jeff Kripal. You don't know Sherilee, but you're going to find out some fascinating things about her and things that she has experienced, including a truly remarkable experience with Anne. Now, Also, we have with us Jeff Kripal, who shared in that experience in a number of ways, and you know him, of course, from Supernatural. He is my co-author on Supernatural. He's been on Dreamland a number of times as well. He is the J. Newton Raiser Professor of Religious Studies at Rice University, and very prominent in that field, more so than he would ever admit. In fact, he's almost a living legend, and I know he's going to be furious at me for saying something like that, but it happens to be true. Welcome to you both. First, welcome, Shirley.
Oh, thank you, Whitley. That was very kind of you. And ask me and, you know, to be talking to me.
Yeah. Jeff, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks, Willie. And I'm not furious at you. No worries.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. I didn't think you would be. I was really kind of joking.
I know.
What we're here to talk about today is some extraordinarily interesting life material. It's what I would call it. Rather than saying, well, Shirley is a psychic, which she sort of circles around, but that's not where she lands. Would that be correct, Shirley?
That's absolutely correct. That's a bad word.
Yeah. Why is that a bad word? I'm curious.
You know, I think it bothers me because I've worked with parapsychologists and other researchers, and it's almost like it's an us versus them word, where, you know, there's a group that thinks they're the researchers, and then the researchers kind of separate themselves from the psychics, and the psychics are this bad group that are going to cheat people and do bad things. Wow. And the researchers are the good guys who, you know, who are after truth. But I think that that's, first off, I think that everybody has these abilities. I think it's just a natural part of human nature. And if you look at just the science of it, Rosenthal back in the 60s showed that there was such a thing called an experimenter effect. So the scientists are just as much a part of that experiment as the participants are. So there really is no us versus them. And whenever I hear the word psychic, I think, you know, basically I've been told by one researcher, all psychics cheat. Well, then I guess we're all cheaters because everybody is psychic. And it's just, it's a word that really is kind of meaningless to me.
I see. Well, you certainly don't cheat. You wouldn't be here if you did. Jeff, what is your reaction to this? You're an academic and therefore very interested in the significance of words, the word psychic.
Yeah. I mean, the word psychic actually goes back to the 1880s and was actually coined by a physicist, believe it or not. In the phrase psychical force. And, you know, it's at that point, it simply referred to essentially psychokinetic forces that had something to do with the psyche or the soul or the mind of the person around whom these effects happen. I think what Cheryl Lee's reacting to, though, is over the course of the last 150 years, skeptics and debunkers and people who don't like these kinds of experiences have been very successful in turning these into bad words. And that's essentially what happened. Psychic now is essentially a bad word, or an abused word at least. And so people don't like to be associated with it. It's something like New Age, say, or any number of other terms we could use, all of which have actually quite noble histories, but which then get picked up and become names we call one another, unfortunately, like kind of like on a playground.
Right. Well, we a lot of us sort of are on a playground, and unfortunately, when it's actually a little more serious than that in many ways. You know, you mentioned the word New Age having a noble history, and you talk about abused words. I want to divert from the subject just a little bit, and we'll get back in a moment. But before we do any diverting or anything else, free Dreamlanders, divert yourselves for just a few minutes with these extraordinary announcements.
Whitley and Ann Streber's book, Miraculous Journey, is well on its way to becoming a classic.
One reader after another has found hope and inspiration in the pages of this deeply moving book. From reader Martin Taylor, a book to savor. Like much of the Strieber's work, this is a very moving read, and I find myself smiling as much as holding back tears. From Melissa Latimer, this is a beautiful, hopeful story of the power of love in the face of life-changing health problems. From Raven Dana, this book is moving, instructive, and most of all, a beautiful testament to the power of love. And from Catherine Cook, the authors guide us through their dark night of the soul with beautiful prose and truly inspiring insights that leave the reader feeling hope and joy. Reader after reader has taken miraculous journey into their heart, and you will too. Available wherever electronic books are sold for just $4.99.
Now also available from Amazon and Barnes & Noble in hardcover and softcover.
There was an incredible UFO wave going on back in 2007. Forgotten all about it? Well, we haven't on unknowncountry.com, and you can still explore it with one of the leading experts who was involved personally, Brian Vike. Listen to this.
A good friend of mine, he's in the UK, believe it or not, and of course I'm in Canada, and between the two of us, just two of us, we pulled in. Now this is going to be a rough one. I think I stopped it at 430. Four reported sightings for Canada alone in 2007.
This is an excerpt from one of literally more than 1,000 different episodes of our various podcasts on unknowncountry.com. But how do you access them? We have a powerful search engine that enables you to access them by subject. But now also, when you go to the podcast drop-down menu, you will see at the bottom, Podcast Archive. This takes you to lists of all of our podcasts organized by year. And you can click on any year and browse through everything that's in that year for that podcast. This is a huge website, and we work more every day to make it accessible. For example, subscribers can now listen to the subscriber version of Dreamland on an app. There are a number of apps out there that will accommodate this, and subscribers will find more information about it in the subscriber section of unknowncountry.com on the Dreamland page. So for this and so much more, the time to subscribe to unknowncountry.com is right now. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe to this website. We need you. And I can assure you, you need us. We're talking to Sherilee Black and Jeff Kripal. His most recent book is The Flip, Who We Really Are and Why It Matters. He is, of course, also the co-author of Supernatural with me, and probably contributed the most trenchant and revolutionary comments to the close encounter experience that ever have been devised by anybody, written down by anybody. And I'm fortunate that they're in that book. But Jeff, just before we left the air, I was going to ask you about another word, which is New Age, which has been extraordinarily abused. Can you tell us a little bit about its actual origin?
Well, real briefly. I mean, it's been coming for a long time, to put it mildly. I mean, people have been talking about a new world or a new age for centuries, if not millennia. But the phrase probably originates in William Blake, believe it or not, the great English romantic poet. And then it gets picked up and really featured in theosophical writing in the early 20th century, and then gets linked to the counterculture, what was called the Aquarian Age, and really kind of comes into what most people think of as the New Age movement in the 1980s. So that's really when it peaks, and then it kind of de-peaks or descends after that into more commercial uses. So that's sort of the origin of it. The basic idea is that there's a new culture or a new age emerging, and that people on the vanguard of this cultural movement are part of this new age.
Well, I don't want to get more deeply into it, but it has been, talk about disparagement. Psychic is a word that's disparaged enough. New Age is too. And, it to be tarred with the, label New Ager is to be pushed into the corner of irrelevance in this world. But we'll try abductee. I mean, that's even worse. So
As I joke with my students at the university, there actually are no words in the study of religion that are not abused. Every single word we use, myth or ritual or paranormal or magic or you name it, all of these words have pretty nasty histories, actually, that involve, you know, people fighting with one another over what these words mean and who gets to own the truth, essentially.
Yeah, who gets to own the truth. And speaking of owning the truth, Sherilee, I want to get back to what I regard as one of the most extraordinary life experiences I've ever known. And I would like you to tell me and to tell our listeners what it was that you first noticed about yourself that seemed different.
Oh, gosh. You know, I didn't notice it at first because really I was always kind of different. You know, I had my first what seemed like, my first memory of an ND when I was quite small. And really my brother used to refer to me as the alien.
I wonder why that would be.
You know, so I was always kind of different. And I think, you know, the thing that I found is when I was really little, it was cute. Everyone thought it was just, you know, I was cute and imaginative, and I had my imaginary friends that I talked to that seemed to sometimes give me good information. I guess Christmas is coming up. I'll tell you a story about it's my dad's favorite Christmas story. But apparently when I was a little girl, I asked for this tea set for Christmas, and it wasn't like, you know, I would hope to get this tea set. It was like, this is what Santa's going to get me this year, and I'm so excited about it. And my parents were like, they really wanted, I was kind of at that age where it might have been my last Christmas where I'd believe in Santa. So they told my older brothers, you are not ruining this for her. Any disparaging comments about Santa will be harshly dealt with in this house. You know, like, we're going to give her this, a good Christmas. And they looked everywhere for this tea set, and I had described it in the greatest detail. I mean, it was going to have a porcelain teapot, and there'd be blue flowers on it. And I just went on and on, and my parents looked everywhere for this thing, and they couldn't find it. And they kept trying to steer me away from the whole idea that, you know, well, you know, whatever Santa brings you, I'm sure it'll be wonderful. Like, we'll have a great Christmas. And I'm like, seriously, Mom, no, Santa's going to bring me this. And as it turned out, my dad's company had this Christmas party every year where they'd have Santa who would give presents to the kids. And it turned out that year, when I sat on Santa's knee, he handed me this lovely wrapped box, which I ran back to my parents, and I'm like, see, look, look, look. And I opened it up, and it was the tea set with the blue porcelain tea set with flowers, and it was exactly as I had described. And I said, see, I've told you all along, Santa has this. And I swear there wasn't a Santa skeptic in our house for years after that.
That's a great story.
Yeah, I should say. So you have a something in you because you've also been you've also experienced psychokinesis.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, well, see, I'm not sure how far back to go with that. I mean, that popped up in childhood too, but I think that really, it really didn't occur to me that it was me doing it until I was an adult. And that took a long time. Like, those were just things that happened. Like, what's the expression? Like, just one of those things when weird things happen. And And they're pretty common in my family. My mom has a lot of those things. Like you know, my mom's last new car, the windows would go up and down by themselves when the car was parked and locked. And she'd take it into the dealership, and they'd tell her there's absolutely no way that the car could do that. So they weren't going to fix it, that she was just crazy. But I've seen her car windows go up and down by themselves when the car is parked and locked. So it happens. You know, and I mean, just the history of my parents, where my mom, you know, the coffee pot would come on in the middle of the night, and she'd blame my dad. My dad would be like, no, it's not me. And the TV set would come on, and she'd be like blaming the cat for, you know, and I grew up just thinking, oh, just must be very smart cats wandering around the house turning on appliances. Like, I didn't know. So, I mean, I kind of grew up with it. And really, in my family, like, nobody acknowledges it. It's just one of those things. It's just weird stuff happens, and you ignore it. And as an adult, it tends to come up, bubble to the surface whenever I'm under a lot of stress. So when things are going bad, that's when light bulbs go out and computers malfunction. And things got really bad when I was in graduate school. And I actually left graduate school because, you know, the situation just became unbearable there. I mean, I have a master's degree, but I'd been working on a doctorate. And I don't want to get into all the details because the university has made it very clear to me that if I were to come forward, they've got more lawyers than I can afford to protect, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. So basically things were going crazy at the university. And I mean, when you're studying science, the last thing you want is to find out that there's some strange force that's going to change the results the machines are giving you.
Yeah, that would be awkward.
That, yeah, you know.
Listen to that laugh of Jeff's back in the background.
You know, when you're spending, you know, all this time in the laboratory, and to find out that those machines are being influenced by things that you can't necessarily control, and it really got crazy. I mean, one student called me a witch because we had an argument over how he was treating a female undergrad student, and his computer had a meltdown, which cost him like quite a lot of data.
Oh my goodness.
You know, and the lights would go on and off as I'd walk under them. It was really going crazy. And like I said, when you're studying science, that's not what you want to have happening in your world.
No, free dreamlanders, here's something you do want happening in your world, which are these announcements. The Afterlife Revolution is getting great reviews. There's a tremendous, lovely response to it, and I'm so pleased and humbled because it's an effort on the part of myself and Anne. And I love Anne so much. I want her to succeed in this incredible task that she has undertaken of returning and communicating across the bridge between the worlds. And she's really doing it. This is a real thing that's happening. Listen to some of these reviews. Anne and Whitley Strieber lay out their life's work in the most exquisitely beautiful manner. This moving book comes from the heart, the unified heart of two people who have dedicated their lives in this realm and the next to revealing the nature of consciousness as it makes its sojourn in this human form. That's just one. Here's another. I love, love this book. It's a wonderful read, especially if you lost somebody very close to you. Just incredible. Here's another one. The book shows you how to grow your soul, for lack of a better term. Through Anne's insight, Whitley shares invaluable information that could only be from the other side. So take it seriously. Go to Amazon and get Afterlife Revolution. Go on to Amazon and get the Afterlife Revolution in paperback or in Kindle format. And if you have questions or thoughts, write me at whitley@strieber.com. I'm right here. I'm ready to answer anything you ask to help you in any way I can, always. As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. This is just a quick reminder that the unknowncountry.com store is now open. You can enter it by going to unknowncountry.com and clicking on the store tab. You'll find all of my available books and much more. We're talking to Sherilee Black and Jeff Kripal. I think since Sherilee prefers not to call herself a psychic, let's call her an unusual and sometimes fairly dangerous person, at least to herself. And Jeff is, I think, simply brilliant and so capable of cutting through all of the cultural and intellectual resistance to the extremely strange and looking at it for what it is. Now, Jeff, we have been listening to Sherilee's litany of woes, being called a witch, things going on and off, results changing in her apparently fairly hopeless attempt to become a scientist, which makes me laugh. I mean, because I think that these forces or presences are anti-scientific in ways that the scientific community does not really understand at all. Jeff, what is your response to the question of presences and powers and their relationship to us through the medium of culture?
Well, I mean, what struck me most about Sherilee's story was, you know, her basic realization eventually that these forces actually were her. I mean, I take it from your story, Sherilee, that your original thinking as a small child or in your family was that these things were either just oddities in the environment that should be ignored or that they were coming from something or someone else. And at some point you recognized that they were in fact coming from you.
That's right, yeah.
And I think that's the move that we need to be making. A lot of her experiences remind me a lot of Elizabeth Crone, whom I know you know.
We've had you and Elizabeth on the show, in fact. It just remind us a little bit about Elizabeth before.
Well, Elizabeth is a lot like Sherilee in that she's a near-death experiencer. And unlike Sherilee, she did not have these experiences as a child, but she had these experiences after she was struck by lightning. And particularly the electrosensitivity that you're describing, Sherilee, the difficulty with light bulbs and computers and stuff, is something that Elizabeth experiences, particularly under moments of stress again. So there's something about emotional stress and electromagnetic energy that's interacting there that we clearly don't understand. But I don't think that's the nature of your question, Whitley. I think you really are asking me why does the broader culture resist or reject this or call it witchcraft? And I think the answer is that it's scary. It's scary in the sense that it violates the way the world is supposed to work. And people like to assume they know how the world works, particularly scientists, by the way. And when they're confronted with phenomena that clearly don't fit that model, the easiest way to resist it is by calling it names. And if you're religious, there's all kinds of names at your disposal, like witch, that immediately literally demonize the phenomena that aren't about demons at all. It's entirely human, but it's easy to push away.
Yeah, it sure is. And you know, you must have felt very pushed away from what happened to you in your life, Sherilee. But at the same time, it must be fascinating to have a life like that, because after all, you've had and have psychokinetic experiences, which is a very high level of this type of experience in my book.
Well, and I think, you know, it took me a long time to really come to peace with that. I mean, part of it was, you know, while I was still at the university, I spent like every Friday afternoon, I was like trying to find references to this kind of effects in the literature. And it's so hard. You know, one of the problems with how the words become kind of laden with baggage and then they change them is that it's really hard to find things when you're looking for it in the literature. Because you go anomalous, well, that's too general a term. If you do a search, you know, a search of any scientific journal, you're going to find tons of stuff under anomalous that has nothing to do with this. But you put in something more specific, like poltergeist or ghost, you don't find anything because, well, the search engines for science don't like those terms. You know?
Right. They don't like those terms. Well, the reason they don't is that it's kind of a bottomless pit for them. They can't quantify, and therefore they can't replicate.
Well, but see, that's not entirely true. You can if you really dig into these things. Like one of the things I was able to do was I started setting up my own experiments just to try and understand what was going on with myself, and I did find ways to quantify the effects. And I actually wrote a paper co-authored with Jim Carpenter, who at the time was the president of the Parapsychological Association, and he presented that work at one of their conferences. So, yeah, you can do it.
Well, tell us a little bit about what your methodology was. What did you do?
Well, originally my plan was that, because everything I'd read said that if you study this stuff, it kind of goes away. So my plan was I was going to cure myself. Like, that was really my driving thing for a number of years, is I was going to cure myself of these effects by studying the effects. So I set up a little pinwheel, and I would try and get it spinning. And at first, I could get the pinwheel spinning, but I couldn't get it to spin when the camera was on. Then I finally got it over that step, and I got it so that I could spin it with the camera on, and then I got it so that I could spin it inside a sealed jar with the camera on. And so my methodology was, and I did this pretty much every night for more than a year, was I would set up my pinwheel, I would take a Panis mood score, which helps to, it's basically a way of quantifying your emotions. It's a test used by psychologists. And so my thought was I was going to quantify my emotional state to see how my emotions affect whether or not that pinwheel will spin and how quickly it will spin. So those were things that I could quantify. I could quantify my emotional state with the Panis mood score. I could quantify whether or not, because it was like a yes or no answer, did it spin or did it not spin? So that was another thing I could quantify. And then my third thing that I could quantify was how quickly did it start spinning when I started the camera and the test. So you can quantify things like that, and you can learn things from that. And what I learned was, yes, my emotions did have some bearing on whether or not it would spin. And in terms of how quickly it would spin, that actually seemed to have more to do with just practice. So the more I practiced, the faster I could get it to spin. But if it wasn't going to spin, that really had more to do with my state of mind at the time. So there, quantified and learned. And it was a study it's a self-study, so there are some limits to, you know, how accepted a self-study is, but it was still something that everyone could learn something from.
Yes, and it must have annoyed quite a few people who don't want to learn that sort of thing from anything, let alone from a self-administered study.
Well, those sort of people aren't going to be paying attention to what's published in the Parapsychological Association proceedings.
Well, that's very true. How has this unfolded in your life? In other words, do you use it? Do you use psychokinetic abilities in your daily life? Or do they – we've talked a little bit about what burning out lights and stuff. I call those electronic seizures. I have them too. And a lot of people listening are nodding their heads because this is a show that appeals to people like us. So anyway, have you ever managed any practical applications where you take control?
Where I take control?
Yeah.
No, I really, for me, a lot of it was just getting it so that I wouldn't blow out light bulbs in the house. And actually what I found was that if I kind of gave myself a target, like that little pinwheel, and said, okay, going to do something, just spin that wheel and leave the light bulbs alone. Yeah. That it seemed to do that. And I mean, really, I don't go around wanting to do this on a big scale. I just wanted to kind of calm down the bad effects of it. You know, and I've certainly managed to do that. And that was one good thing about doing the experiment, is that it made me feel more in control of something that was kind of controlling me for a while.
Right.
You know, but on the other hand, I think that I've certainly put it to use in terms of going to laboratories, that I could be, you know, contributing to science that way. I've been to Michael Persinger's lab in Sudbury twice. You know, I've been to the Ryan Research Center, and I did a really brief visit at UVA, and I've been to a couple of other labs in the U.S. And I mean, I think, you know, like Persinger and Bill Roll, they're the ones who actually published and wrote the most informative paper of any of the places I've gone. They've actually published more in it. And Persinger also included me. He named an effect after me. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, I should say so.
This black effect of psychokinesis.
Right.
And I thought that was even cooler because, like, you know, the other people he talks about, it's in a chapter of a book. And, you know, he mentions, like, Ingo Swann, you know, and Sean Harabance, who were, like, really, really up on their games for, you know, the things that they did over the years. So I thought that was a pretty impressive company to put me in.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think it's a very impressive company indeed. Now, Jeff, there is a huge culture of experience surrounding psychokinesis. Can you tell us about some of the more notable events in the history of psychokinesis?
I'm not sure I can, other than this is where we get the word paranormal, really. It's coined in 1903 in French, and it's meant to describe these very events that were called poltergeist phenomena, because the assumption was that these were noisier or angry or upset ghosts in the room that were breaking things or throwing things or moving things. And what the researchers eventually realized or concluded was, again, it wasn't a ghost. It was a living being. It was a living person around whom these sorts of things happen. So, yeah, I mean, I think these things have been going on for all of human history, and they're usually described in whatever the mythical or scientific language of the day happens to be. You know, there were once poltergeists, now we call them psychokinetic. You and I mean, I experienced them with Cheryl Lee, actually. Some of the most interesting events, you know, certainly in my interaction with Cheryl Lee, were books moving around in her house that she was writing me about, and or she lost her glasses, I think, once. But then, of course, the drawing that I hope we can talk about eventually.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about the drawings later on in the show, for sure.
Not quite psychokinetic in this sense, but somehow related. I mean, it's a physical effect that manifests through Cheryl Lee and ended up having a lot of empirical plausibility. Yeah, I think these are fascinating, and again, they're not that rare, and they're not unusual to Cheryl Lee, and she's not the only person who tries to study them to get rid of them.
Right.
That's essentially again what Elizabeth wanted. She wanted to write this book with me to essentially cure herself, and you actually were one of the most significant people that helped convince her that these were not curses, these were in fact gifts.
And, well, exactly, you know, they are gifts.
Well, that was a real transformation for Elizabeth, and I think that's a real transformation for a lot of people, to realize you're not being haunted, you're not a witch, you're not demonic, you're gifted. And you know, if I could just say the one thing I always disagree with people here, and I'll just in a friendly disagreement with Sherry Lee, I just don't think for a second that we're all capable of these things. I think it might be metaphysically true that we're possibly capable, but the truth is most people are not capable of these things. And when someone like Sherry Lee, who's gifted, says that, I always hear that as an admirable expression of humility. You know, they wish it were true or they think it's true, but it's in fact not true. There's something special about some people. And I would definitely put you, Whitley, and you, Sherry Lee, you know, in that special camp. And as you know, Whitley, I would put myself in that non-special camp. So I think that's important to say. I think there's something really special here and really positive that needs to be affirmed as different.
You know, I don't know where you really are, Jeff. You may not think of yourself as that, but you had you were touched briefly by one of the visitors. I mean, not physically, perhaps, but
oh, sure.
At Esalen, when we were rooming together, foolish man that you were.
I recognize that, but I just don't know of any human skill, and I think this is a skill, that's distributed evenly through the population. And so I don't know why these skills would be evenly distributed, because no other skill. And so I just want to record my friendly difference.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I would say to that in some people, I think that the, you know, like there's the sheep goat effect, where I think some people are just so strongly against it that they suppress these effects, you know, and understandably so, because they can cause major meltdowns.
Well, you tried to suppress them.
That's right. You know,
me too.
You know, yeah. But some people, I don't know. I think some people do it kind of on an unconscious level where they're very effective at it. It's almost like they're stronger than we are.
The last time it happened in this house was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, when I began to notice that a number of things that use batteries, clocks and things, were not working. And it turned out that overnight, when I had a visitor experience, every battery in the house was dead. So I began replacing them, only to discover that all the batteries in the closet were dead too. So I had to go out and buy new batteries. That was very frustrating.
But, I'm speaking
to the choir here, because you know a lot about these things, Jeff, and Sherry Lee experiences them too.
Yeah.
What Although, you know, sometimes, do you not find that sometimes these experiences are contagious?
You know, I'm glad to say that never happened in my marriage with Anne. But I will say this. It was not until we got together that strange things began to happen in my life that as an adult. I had a lot of odd things happen as a child. But then after I met Anne, it started to get really weird, and we were so young and innocent and so involved in our love affair that we just laughed all of this bizarre stuff off until finally it blew up in our faces in 1985. So, yeah, to a degree. I want to get back to, we've kind of covered psychokinesis, and what I would like to do now, Sherry Lee, is to go to down a road that will lead eventually to the material about you and Anne, and which is your near-death experience. So if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I've had more than one, so I kind of have to go quick.
Yeah, sure. No, don't hurry. Tell, we're here to listen.
Okay. Well, I had my first one when seems to me like a memory of a near-death experience when I was a toddler. And basically, We had an old house with a steep basement staircase, and the door was locked, and my pet dog was basically locked in the basement because we had company over. And we had a big dog that kind of drooled on people and was bouncy, and my parents had put it in the basement to keep it away from some relatives who weren't keen on the dog. And being a toddler and loving my dog, I somehow found a way to unlock that door, and I fell down the basement stairs and hit my head. Mm-hmm. And what I remember of that experience was basically it was just kind of a dark, kind of an indigo light. And I just remember this lady picking me up, and it was just, the whole experience was just like this warm hug. And being a little kid at the time, I just thought, I want my dad. Like, you're a nice lady. This is all great. Where's dad? And that's kind of my next memory, is my dad holding me and everything, you know, everything was fine. And that's, I mean, I don't have it, you know, I was very, very little, so I don't have a great deal of memory of it. But clearly I was a different, you know, little child growing up. And you know, like I look at my old report cards and the teachers write things like, Cheryl is in her own world. You know, but cute and imaginative, and people didn't really bother me about it when I was little. And then when I was 10 years old, I had my appendix burst. And it was one of those situations where both my parents worked, and I had seemed fine on the weekend, and my brothers thought that I was just faking being sick on Monday morning to avoid school, which would not have been out of character for me. You know, I was that kind of little kid, and everybody was just kind of, oh yeah, she's fine. She just doesn't want to go to school. Well, as it turned out, I was really, really sick, and I could have died that day. Like, you know, my parents took me to our family doctor, who looked at me and quickly called an ambulance to rush me to the hospital where I had surgery. And what I remember of that one, well, it's kind of a long story. I remember a lot of things, but that was a really terrifying experience for me. And I don't like to talk about that one too much because it still is really upsetting.
Can you give us a hint? Because we're going to be very curious.
I know. I did write it down in a book if I ever published it.
If you ever publish it, yeah.
But basically in that one, you know, like most kids, I wanted my mom and dad. Like, I kept going in and out of my body at first. Like, I was in so much pain. And, well, you know, I was waiting for surgery, and it was like I was being sucked in and out of a straw. I just kept popping out of myself just to get away from the pain. And at one point, I thought, I want my mom and dad. And then I kind of saw them. And what I saw really shocked me is that they were fighting, because they felt very guilty about not taking the situation more seriously, that they waited longer, and instead of rushing me to a hospital emergency room, they took me to the family doctor, who I guess is like, why are you taking her here? You should, you know, she needs to go straight to the hospital. And I don't think I'd ever seen them fight before. You know, like that was just one of those things where, you know, I was at an age where some of my friends had parents who divorced, and that was like the most horrible thing I could possibly imagine ever happening in my universe at that age. And I saw my parents fighting, and I thought it was like all my fault, you know, like kids do. And I just wanted to get away. And it's like that part of me that was kind of wandering around and checking out where my parents were in the hospital. I just went as far away as I could. And it was a very dark, scary experience at that point. And I had kind of two visions of a possible future. One of them in which I died and everything went to hell for my family. My parents split up. You know, it was just, it was, you know, if I died, everything bad happened that I left behind. Whereas if I came back, things are going to be okay. My parents would stay together. Things would be fine. And my, you know, my parents are still together.
Yes.
You know, they've been together for, more than 60 years. So they've done well.
Yeah.
You know, they've done well as marriages go. But when it was like when I was in that really, really darkest part of that experience, and it just seemed like it wasn't fair. Like there was, because I had, like, it was like there was two me's. And I mean, that's kind of the biggest difference I found between my childhood experiences and my adult experiences, was my childhood experiences, there really seemed like there was little me who you know, was a 10-year-old and thought of things in a 10-year-old way. And then there was this bigger me who had all this really adult information that little me didn't want to know about. Like, I didn't want to know about sex yet. You know, like, things like that.
Right.
Like, did not want to know about any of that. You know, then there was this bigger me who kind of knew all this stuff and was okay with all this stuff. And little me really didn't agree with all that. And I just went farther and farther away. And I guess the only way I can describe the horror part of that is that it's like when you're a little kid in a supermarket and you let go of mom's hand and you wander around and then you look and mom's gone and you don't know where mom is. And it's like, oh my God, I don't know where mom is. I had her by the hand and what an idiot, I let go of her hand and now I'm alone and my universe, like, everything is as dark as it can ever be. I'm lost and I will never be found. And that's how I, you know, that was that feeling, you know? I mean, that's the closest thing I can think of to describe it. It's just that feeling of complete and utter loss and desolation. Was that when you lose your mom in the supermarket when you're a little kid. And thankfully, when there were light beings there who wanted to help me, but there was this part of me who was like, no, you're an adult. I am not listening to adults. Adults are idiots. They're the ones arguing about me at the hospital right now. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I was kind of going, I was just on the cusp of that age where you start to distrust adults anyway. And, you know, and there was all of that going on, but in the end, when I finally was just at my lowest point, and I said, okay, I'd really like some help getting back now, and I encountered, like, really scary things, like, scary individuals that I, you know, some pointed out that they were kind of like demons. I said, well, I didn't think of them as demons or anything. That wasn't really in my vocabulary, because I wasn't really raised with religion, so that wasn't how I just thought they were scary things when you get to these desolate regions, you know, these desolate places in the universe.
Yes.
Wherever I was. But when I finally asked for help, I got help. And I came back and I lived and my family was okay and my parents stayed together and everything was all right. I was a very different kid after that, too. And it sort of brought in the darker part of these experiences.
Yeah, I can certainly understand that. And Jeff, well, you know, before we go a little any farther, Free Dreamlanders, you've had a nice long period of fascinating listening. So why don't you do us a favor and not only listen to these announcements, but do what they plead with you so gently and so insistently and so convincingly to do.
Say yes to Serious Wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter. Free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. Live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to Serious Wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
The key, the mystery, The Wonder, now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin. Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. We're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you. The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
We're talking to Sherilee Black and Jeff Kripal. Sherilee is a psychokinetic individual with all kinds of phenomenal experiences, including some experiences with Anne that we're going to get into now. And Jeff Kripal, his most recent book is The Flip. You should certainly check it out. I've read it, and it is, well, it'll flip you out. It's a terrific book. And he's the co-author with me of Supernatural, and he plucked me from oblivion is the way I look at Jeff. He came into my life, and suddenly I found myself with a presence in the academic community when I had been such a complete outsider before. So he is one of my great life heroes. Now, going on down the road, one day, a few years ago, Jeff, Sherilee sent you a picture, a drawing. Can you tell us why she sent you the drawing? We won't ask you who the drawing was of, because you did not know at the time. You didn't recognize it, which doesn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise Anne either, you being a man. But any case.
A dull man, yeah.
Yeah. Why did she send you a drawing?
Well, Sherilee and I had been corresponding for a number of years, on and off. I actually hear from a lot of experiencers because of the things I write about, and I try my best to correspond, to write back. And so Sherilee and I had been in contact. She wrote me, it was a little before Christmas. I mean, I was looking at it actually before this interview, and she was talking about this figure that was appearing in her room that looked a lot like Princess Leia in the Star Wars episode. And, honestly, we were having medical issues in the family, and I was overwhelmed at work. And I just actually didn't have time to answer Sherilee or to even take a close look at the image, which she eventually sent me as well. And then in late December, I finally took a close look at it, and I still didn't recognize it. And so I sent it to my friend Diana Pasolka, who almost immediately wrote back and said, Jeff, that's Anne Strieber. And I looked at it, and sure enough, it was almost a perfect likeness of Anne. And so I asked Sarah Lee if she knew Anne or if she had that picture or how'd she know about it? And, you know, she can speak for herself now, but I mean, basically she didn't know. And I asked her if I had her permission to contact Whitley or yourself, Whitley. And she said, sure. And so I did. And so I got the four of us talking and, we all agreed it was Anne. You even had the photo that it was clearly based on.
Yes, and listeners, if you go to the Dreamland homepage, you'll see the photo and the drawing side by side, a photo which was not on the internet at all at the time Shirley did the drawing.
And I don't know how far you want me to go here, Willie, but I mean, the real revelation for me is when maybe it was late January or so, I was looking at the picture closer and I realized that, you know, the image I had seen was a low resolution image, but when you sent me a high resolution image and we blew it up, it clearly had the word Anne written all through it. Dozens of times. And I pointed this out to you and Cheryl Lee and Diana, and then, you know, we had a whole nother conversation about, you know, Anne's love of a particular New Yorker cartoonist who did the same thing with his daughter, Nina. And, you know, so I'll let the two of you fill that story in. But for me, it was this really powerful four-way interaction between four human beings through which gradually emerged this picture of a woman who was supposedly dead, but of course not dead, communicating with us through Cheryl Lee, through you, through this drawing. And it was all very moving. And it transpired over, I'd say, 2 or 3 months. It was not quick.
Now, that drawing is now, which Cheryl Lee was so kind to give to me, is now framed in my living room. And it's something that I can gaze at all the time. And I often do. And the photograph is right beside it.
And the last thing I'll say about it before Cheryl Lee fills us in on her side of the story, but, you know, of course, I was in touch with Cheryl Lee through the whole thing, and afterwards, I was so moved by it that I wanted to write about it, and I wanted to talk about it. I often, you know, this was pre-pandemic, so I often traveled and gave lectures, and so I actually gave a lecture called Drawn In twice, one to the Jung Center in San Francisco, and once for a plenary lecture that I gave out east at a university. And, you know, so I talked about this four-way relationship and this drawing and, you know, what I made of it all. So it was quite moving to me, actually, and still to this day is one of the clearest examples, certainly I know of some kind of communication to.
Yeah, I think so. Anne is very present, and I feel her presence now, of course. I would inevitably, because of what we're talking about. Unfortunately, I'm not a good channel. I fear always that I'm intervening in some way. And I fear that now. I sense Anne saying, I'm here and I've been here. You're not listening to me. But I don't know whether that's me or Anne. I can't tell the difference. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm not a channel, even though I have ended up married to someone who is an expert after-death communicator, which gets me back to the drawing. And let's circle back now to you, Cheryl Lee. And this was not the first drawing of this kind that you had done, was it?
No, I'd actually done some drawings for a parapsychologist who I'd been doing Skype sessions with, and it actually had kind of come up where he wanted me to communicate with one individual, and I kept saying, well, I keep seeing someone who calls herself Annie. and even then, it was like the Princess Leia costume, which... Yeah. which is what got my attention, because that's an odd costume, but that's not Carrie Fisher. And actually at the time, Carrie Fisher was still alive when the original sightings, and I kept saying, no, I keep seeing Annie, and there was like a cat and a dog, and somebody, well, I'm not going to use the name because I don't know if you want the name out there, but there was a name. And I was like, well, that's who I'm getting. And unfortunately, this person did not, that wasn't what he wanted. And so it was like he kept telling me, no, I want you to do something else. And I'm like, but this is who I see.
So,
you know, and I didn't really know what to do with that. I just kind of filed it and didn't worry about it at the time. I have to ask you, though, like, when you look at the original drawing, do you see the name Anne written all over it?
Oh, yeah. It's written all in the lines.
Oh, I know, but, like, is it really odd? Because, I mean, I drew it and I didn't notice it.
Well, she was sending a message to me, a very personal message. There are two of them. First, the cat and the dog. She's with Candy, my childhood dog, who she always used to joke was my other wife. And because we used to sleep together. And when Anne first came down to San Antonio to meet my family in 1969, we weren't married. And so we weren't sleeping in the same room, at least not in San Antonio, although that may or may not have been true in New York, obviously. But, Candy would sleep with me, and she peeked in the room late at night, and there we were, lying in bed with the dog's head beside my head on the pillow. And she, forever after, she teased me that Candy was my first wife because she got to sleep with me in San Antonio when she didn't. So, and then the cat, of course, was Co, who, if you read about Anne's near-death experience in Miraculous Journey or her listen to her talk about it on Dreamland and in Mysterious Powers. Her cat Co was her guide in the afterlife when she had her own near-death experience. So, and Co was a huge, huge spiritual part of our family in his life and after death too. So that's why they were there. Now, as to the drawing, the hidden Anns all through it are amazing. And I counted, I think, 21 of them. And the reason they're there is that Hirschfeld, Jeff alluded to earlier, was a cartoonist who did caricatures, not for the New Yorker, but for the New York Times every Sunday in what used to be the drama section in the dear old days when it had one. And each caricature would have a number on it, a little number in the corner. And that was the number of times in his sort of swirling style, the name of his daughter, Nina, was present in the caricature. And we used to have fun counting all the Ninas on Sunday mornings back in the early days. And we together, and Annie, of course, always won because she had a very quick eye, and I was too analytical. I was never sure about whether that was an actual Nina or not, and on, blah, blah. In any case, and that may have been Anne talking through me just now, actually. In any case, that's why the Anns were there, and you didn't know they were there. You had no idea.
No. And I mean, you know, and I didn't see them until, it's funny because Jeff went and sent us, like, you know, I had done a good scan because I figured, okay, I'm going to send you the drawing, but before I do, I'll make a good scan of it. Like, once it's out of the sketchbook, it's easier to do a good scan and make a copy of it for myself. And I had upped the contrast a little bit, but I didn't really look at it. I just copied it and then I sent it out to everyone saying, okay, well, everybody here have a nice copy of this picture we've been talking about. And then Jeff gets back to us and goes, okay, am I the only one who saw the Anns here? And nobody responded.
No, I didn't see him until Jeff pointed them out.
Yeah. It's like, and I mean, and I didn't even look. I'm like, yeah, just imagining things. I mean, for me, that's pretty rich. But I mean, you know, I just thought, yeah, right. Just you know. Just seeing stuff is like, you know, like pareidolia or whatever it is where you see faces and things where there's no faces. You're just seeing Anns where there's no Anns.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're talking about life in a broader, bigger reality. that includes what, as Anne used to say, put it, what we call the dead. There's not, that's not real. That we are, what we are bodies that are injected into the stream of time so completely that we really can't see much except what is directly in front of us. We have on blinders. And somehow or another, somebody, every once in a while, people lose their blinders, and yours kind of fell off at some point. And I guess mine have too, and probably a lot of my listeners and more every day. And I haven't mentioned you, Jeff, because I know you, that your blinders are welded on right now, but they will fall off.
But you, to my credit, I did see the ends. And
yes, you're the one who saw the ends. That's right.
Yeah, and to, you know, this is, I'm not bragging here. I'm just telling the story. To Shirley's credit, these are not fuzzy things that you have to project the word "and" into. The word "and" actually appears 21 times in this drawing. There's no doubting.
No doubt whatsoever. No, none.
It's like really clear, but you can't see it just looking at the drawing. It's like this weird kind of special effect. You got to hone in on it. And so anyway, that's, I thought it was very funny too, Shirley, that the dull guy saw the name, the medium and the abductee and the scholar of UFOs didn't.
Yeah.
I got to take credit where I get it, right? You got to do.
Well,
gotta,
you should take credit because, yeah, you know,
yeah, you got to be good for something.
Yeah, well, you're good for, oh, goodness, don't deprecate yourself. You are an absolutely central figure in all of this, and I think that if the reality unfolds in the way it looks like it's going to, and that these things are coming more and more into focus, then your contribution, your enormous contribution, will be recognized. Well, we have reached the end of the first part of the show. In the second part, in the third half hour, I should say, I'm going to ask a question about a very unusual experience that happened to me a few weeks ago that I've already written Jeff and Shirley about, and Shirley had some wonderful thoughts about it. Jeff has got to leave us, unfortunately, but Shirley and I intend to soldier on for the half hour, exploring more and more deeply, and I think Jeff will be interested in this. I wish you could stay. In fact, why don't you stay for the first 10 minutes or so? I know you have that much time.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so Jeff will be with us for the first few minutes of our discussion. And Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much, as always, for being with us. And once again, I urge you to go over to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. Jeff's new book is The Flip. You should go and look at it on Amazon. It's a marvelous book, a delightful book, and also filled with insight about this flip that's taking place. We are changing, really changing. And in our Christmas show in the next few weeks, we will talk to Jeff again, and we'll talk exclusively about the flip. Free Dreamlanders, thank you for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by unknowncountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.